Hello again, this is Frank Rogorski, and I am welcoming you to the third Leaders for Tomorrow audio disc. I am a family audio chronicler from Northern Virginia, and my main website is exactingeditor.com. Now, on this disc, our sole guest is the person who made Leaders for Tomorrow possible and is taking it to new levels of family research and media awareness. Yes, that would be Andrea Shera. Those of you who know and cherish her are allowed to skip right to the next track, which is where the interview begins. But I would like to use this opening track to explain what we're doing to everyone else, that is, to the people who are not familiar with Leaders for Tomorrow. After all, a movement grows by adding new listeners and additional doers. But even if you don't believe in movements, we do have a very focused product here, or a project. You see, we did this CD to showcase a manuscript, and it's a manuscript that won't become a full-fledged book for probably another year. Therefore, whether you have worked with Andrea or not, we are all getting familiar with a book project, her book project, and by understanding it this early, in the summer of 2005, you might be able to contribute. Now, with this planned book, Andrea is doing something that takes, I think, a lot of guts. She is using nearly three decades of experience in what they call family systems theory to redefine leadership. She intends to make it individual as opposed to corporate, and to make it intrinsic as opposed to mechanical. Now, if she can do that, and if she can transform the conception and the practice of leadership, she will have distinguished it from the hierarchical and group-oriented norms, the other-directedness that seems to characterize the larger companies and many of the management books. Maybe you're skeptical. Well, from time to time, I am also skeptical about what she's doing in this book. Rather than get knocked off course by my skepticism, Andrea shrewdly uses me as a reality check. And it's somewhat easier for her to tolerate the skepticism because I am only her audio editor. For the book endeavor itself, that is, working on text and doing the research, Andrea's hired Deb Schwab, who is introduced later on the CD. But hey, enough about Deb and Frank. We are the assistants to Andrea. You are the listener. And it's quite possible that you are working with little more than what I am able to convey right here on this opening track. In fact, let's just assume that you have just this single audio disc and are waiting to find out, on track one, how to use it. Okay, time for the roadmap. Through the end of track three, we will be covering the bio. Does that matter? You're damn right it matters. Every author deserves a chance to explain where they came from and how they got here. It doesn't mean that the whole book needs to be an autobiography, because that gets tiring. But one chapter at least needs to convey who is doing the writing, where they came from, and hopefully why you should pay attention to them and the authenticity of what of their life course and their path. And if you want to get to know Andrea Shera, I think the first 20 minutes of the talk here managed to be concise as well as candid. First question, and the audience should note that she has seen some of these, but most of them she has not, so most of this is unrehearsed. Where did you go to college, and how worthwhile was it?
Well, part of that's easy to answer, and the second part is a little harder. Where did I go to college? I went to two colleges. I went to Marymount in Tarrytown, and then I went to Georgetown University. And those two experiences were lifetimes apart. So I went to Marymount when I was 18.
All right.
Okay, and that was the experience of an 18-year-old. Just being at Marymount, it's more like when you're young, it's almost a socializing experience. And you're leaving high school, you're learning that you're not so important as you were in high school, and you've got a more mature group of people that you're going to have to deal with. And if you were first in your class, now you're with everybody who was first in their class. So you might be in the middle of your class.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a challenge, socially, academically.
Did you want to go there?
No, I did not want to go there. I wanted to, I wanted to be a tennis teacher. And I wanted to go to Barry College in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother said, now wait a minute. Tennis teacher, you're not going to have a job. What are you going to work? I mean, you're a Southern woman. I mean, you're not going to work. I mean, what year is this? This is 1960. Come on. Mm-hmm. She wasn't quite that funny, maybe, but she made the point that she was going to pay for the education, and I needed to think carefully about the kind of school I was going to go to and the kind of future I was going to have. And if I was a Southern woman, what made sense to me was I needed to be exposed to people in the North who thought differently, who acted differently. And although I'd gone to boarding school for 4 years at Georgetown Visitation, I needed a little more exposure to the Northern mind and the social environment and not limit myself to the South.
And that were growing up in the Norfolk area?
I was growing up in Virginia Beach, Norfolk.
Okay.
And I was raised mostly by my grandparents, who were socially in a high echelon socially, so a lot of expectations of women to be Southern women, organized, kind, thoughtful, but certainly not women who were going to have jobs. But if you were going to have a job, maybe you'd be a teacher or a librarian. But most women get married, and you learn how to deal with society, and you make an impact by being a person who contributes to your community. College was an introduction to a new way of thinking, a new way of being. And a lot of more Northern girls, probably career-oriented, certainly than the Southern girls. But at Marymount, I would still say most of the women that I went to college with were not career-oriented. They were still Catholic girls thinking, I'm going to go to college and I'll find a husband. And so I kind of joined that rank and decided that after 2 years of college, I would get married. So I was 20 years old. My boyfriend at the time was graduating from college, and he was a Catholic, and he too thought, you get out of college, you get married. You find the right kind of woman who's going to help you raise the right kind of children, and that's very important. So, to make the long story short, I got married, had two children after 11 years, was divorced.
At age 31 or 2?
Yes, at 1973, 32. Okay. And, you know, I kind of grew up in this wealthy family, and I didn't really think I still needed to work. And I thought, well, I can easily make a lot of money selling real estate. That's not that hard. And so I went to work for a real estate company and found out, you know what? It really is hard. Then slightly after that, my maternal grandmother died, or slightly before I got divorced, 4 months. And then a year later, my brother had a mental breakdown. And that's when I decided that I really needed to go into psychiatry. That there are more important things than making money, and one of them is gaining knowledge. And being able to have the knowledge that would be useful to my family became an overwhelming urge. So when my brother had this manic depressive episode, which would make a great movie, it was so funny. And if I made the movie, it would be called Seriously Crazy, because mm-hmm. the crazier my brother got, the more serious I and the other members of my family got about trying to control him and make him do the right thing, mm-hmm. which made him more and more crazy. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea about reciprocal functioning and how seesaws work in an emotional process. But I learned very quickly that psychiatry had no idea about this either. They just kind of gave you drugs. And the psychiatrist who was in charge of my brother said, ah, your brother, he's never going to make it. Forget about that. Just, you know, you're a good-looking woman. I'd like to go out with you. And I'm like, what is this? This guy's giving up on my brother, trying to make me feel better about myself. What's that? That's not going to work. So I decided that I could find out more about psychiatry by getting a job in psychiatry rather than going back to school. And I went to work at a psychiatric hospital, and I worked on an alcoholism ward. And I learned a tremendous amount there. I was there for about 6 months when I met Dr. Bowen. And Dr. Bowen was a maverick psychiatrist by all attempts to conceptualize him in a certain slot. He did not fit. He went to Menninger's. He was a psychoanalyst, but he certainly didn't fit with psychoanalysts. He was what I would call a reality-oriented psychiatrist. He was interested in what happened to real people and what did they do, and to heck with diagnosing them for insurance companies. He was more interested in observation, so he would use the term, observe what people do. Don't listen to what they say. Okay. Or if you listen to what they say, correlate what they say with what they're doing.
All right.
So his science was based on observation, just like any ethologist field study. Don't diagnose people. I was working in a psychiatric hospital that made money by diagnosing people, by saying, yes, you're alcoholic, you need to stay here for 30 days. And by the way, that'll cost $10,000.
Okay.
And Ford Motor Company and many other companies were happy to pay that.
So much for objectivity.
And the person who was diagnosed as an alcoholic never knew what was being said about him. There was all this communication with the insurance company, and the medical records went to them, never went to the person. And I found this extremely disturbing. So when I met Dr. Bowen, and he, being the only psychiatrist to talk about his own family and me being interested in my own family and how to function in that family, I immediately knew this man was a man to be respected, the only psychiatrist to ever talk about his own family.
At a professional conference in 1967.
Write about it. Yeah, he wrote about it, called the Anonymous Paper, 1967, and just blew the field apart. They didn't know what to make of him.
Was it known at the conference itself that he was the author?
No. It was a surprise. He was supposed to talk about something else. And just as he did many surprises, he submitted a paper about something else, and then he gave them a paper about his own family.
Okay.
And they were shocked.
But when he did that, they knew it was him as the author?
They knew it was him and about his own family, absolutely.
Okay.
And I think it was Ackerman at the end of the meeting said, I want to be your brother. Love that paper. And Bowen said, I already have a brother. So he was already separating himself as a unique individual in the field of family therapy, which was a reasonably new field.
Right.
But it had a kind of cult-like following because it was new, and people were like, family therapy, of course, that's the answer to everybody's problem. Let's get on the bandwagon. And of course, it's not the easy path. It might be an answer, but it's not the easy path. So many people jumped on the bandwagon and got off. Then the field of family therapy exploded in the 70s and then kind of died down in the late 80s, replaced by drugs. He went to NIH in 1956 to 1960 when the government was very interested in producing more democratic citizens. And they figured, hey, the family is the factory, you know, for producing democratic citizens, and we have to understand the family. So we need to run experiments to understand the family. So they paid for him to hospitalize the whole family at NIH and have people live there for up to 2 years where they could be observed. No diagnosis, no calling people names. But let's see, how do leaders emerge? Who will emerge in an environment if people don't judge and blame the staff? So over time, who emerged? The fathers. The fathers were the first people in these families to be able to take a stand and to be more separate from the group. And as you described, a person who is more separate from the group has to still be able to stay in emotional contact with their wives and children, even though they're taking an unpopular stand. And so these people had to become much more relationship aware in order to take a stand and to maintain contact rather than, you know, I don't care about you, this is what I'm going to do, right or wrong, good or bad, poof. You know, that is not leadership, that is not anything about well-differentiated people or anything about trying to separate a self, because you must maintain your alliances even though you're different.
Your alliances or your connections? It seems to me you're saying, and some of this goes back to our discussion as well for the last year and a half, that separate, differentiate yourself, separate from the group, take a stand, and you're saying, but don't burn your bridges, don't tell people to go to hell.
Yeah,
and exactly. I didn't think it meant
exactly.
that, but there's more to it than that. don't you, when you take a stand, do you not have, and I'm, again, folks, I'm coming out of the world of politics where if you're one person, 99-1, okay, you've taken a stand. Nobody ever hears from you again. You've got to build coalitions. You've got to try to convince people that, that your way is a better way than the way they're doing. Is there any room for persuasion and argumentation and bringing people onto the bandwagon that you started as an individual, but you want more people to go, how are you going to get anything done?
I would say there's a process to it, and it may be that the first time you say it, people are startled and upset. But then if you don't get upset back, that's the key thing. Then you can build the alliances and maintain the connections. So it requires the leader or the person who's emerging and taking a stand to recognize this may upset people, but if I don't get upset back, we'll build a coalition. We'll build alliances and we'll be able to go forward. There will be a buy-in.
Okay.
And most of the time that's what happens, but it's not because you're blackmailing people or forcing them or threatening them. They come to this partially because you've created a space for them to think. They can think for themselves, they can listen to your ideas, and they can consider them, and then they can buy in.
Is there something between, on the one side, this is obviously a loaded question, calm, cool, thinking, NT-type persuasion over time, and blackmailing force and bullying over here? Yeah, there is. It's called management.
Yeah.
And Peter Drucker started to write about it 60 years ago.
Yeah.
You have chains of command, you have salary reviews, you have, here's your, we agree, Greg, that you're going to do these five things over the next year.
Yeah.
If you don't, maybe there'll be trouble, maybe you won't get a raise.
Yeah.
There's a whole realm
contract
of control in there, yeah. Contracts.
Contract negotiation.
That's not bullying, but it's also not just sitting back and trying to convince people to do it your way either.
Yeah, absolutely. What
do you think about that middle realm?
I think it's necessary in business. It may be necessary to write contracts between children and parents even. But certainly there's that realm where either the child or the worker or the professor is willing to give you some amount of their time, some amount of their energy in order to be paid. And that's there's
okay.
Definitely a whole contract in which I agree that I will do X, Y, and Z. And I think that's a legitimate agreement. It's, you can say in a way, if you wanted to, you can say people are forced into it because they have to.
They need a job somewhere.
They need a job. And there is some force. And there are times when people can't choose and cannot leave because of economic conditions and what have you.
Sure.
So there are forces. But if you're thinking about more of an ideal world, you're deluding yourself. You know, there's no ideal world that's going to happen. There's got to be chaos. There's got to be uncertainty. There's got to be difficulties in managing all these relationships. It's not going to be a smooth thing. But thinking about an ideal, I would like to be enough of a self that I could allow you to decide in your own free will if you agree with my ideas. That's certainly a nice ideal statement for families, for husbands and wives, to have
for law firms, for venture capital partnerships.
For anybody that you want to have who's creative, who's intellectual. You certainly want to give them the space and allow for them to buy in on their own volition. But if you're in the Army and you've got to go to war, you don't have time for that, you know. And people buy into that ahead of time. They sign up for the Army. They know what's going to be involved. They're happy to do it. They
so
like
because
that.
We don't have a draft anymore, you would say that command and control in the service at least has a place, and it's a defensible system. And it's still defensible because at least now, since 73, the draft ended.
Mm-hmm.
People are volitionally saying, I'm willing to do this for 2 years or 4 years.
Yes, I'm willing to do it. You're going to pay me. I'll get some reward. It's a cost benefit. And the person there, I mean, my father wanted to go in the war. He didn't have to in the Second World War. But to him, he was a patriot. He wanted to go in. He worked for Curtis LeMay. He was on his intelligence staff. And to him, that was the right thing to do. He bought in and he did things he didn't want to do, but he did it. Because that was his job, and he agreed to the
He
job.
Bought in at the macro level, or
he
the vision level.
Exactly.
And therefore, on a lot of micro stuff, he just said, yes, sir. But,
yes, exactly. Yeah. And there are many times that you have to do that. And to go back to working in a psychiatric hospital, there are many times I had to do that. You know, I had to do things I didn't really want to do, but I didn't have a choice. That was my job, and I had to do it. So you don't have free will, you have contracts. You agree, and you do it. You clean the toilets, you dig the latrines, you do the things you don't want to do. It's part of your job.
When we get to track 4, you will find a striking fusion of the personal and the conceptual. What does that mean? Well, Andrea is going to tell the story of how she deployed the principles of Dr. Murray Bowen, he's the originator of family systems theory, to help her brother. As far as I'm concerned, this is great stuff. It is a great story, a great sequence, because it reveals a way to use psychology that will probably surprise those of our listeners who are outside the family systems movement. Tracks 5 and 6, they explain where the idea for the book comes from and who are the intended audiences. Andrea is also going to rule out certain types of people as prospective readers, at least in large numbers. Rule out readership? Well, as an editor by trade, I have no problem with doing that. In fact, I would argue that it's a necessary step if any manuscript is to keep its focus. To lead is to choose. To write is to assume that certain types of people are going to read what you have to write, what you are saying. To organize a book is to boil down life lessons and then spread them around. But I still say we have to be careful, and I hope Andrea is careful, about assuming that those lessons can be universalized. This gets back to my skepticism. I have been wondering, and I still wonder, how applicable are the concepts of Murray Bowen and Andrea Scherer when it comes to leadership and management, when it comes to going beyond individuals in a defined family unit, when it comes to corporations and government agencies where cliques and groupthink and factionalism remain the workaday norm.
You've had almost 30 years of experience with family systems theory as defined by Murray Bowen. Is it not the case with almost all of us that when we discover a new idea, a new set of ideas, a new person, a new set of influences, group, whatever, it's almost like a child learning to walk or learning to read and write. There's a huge spike on the graph where a whole bunch of things come in very quick, and some of them are adapted, some of them are adapted clumsily, but it's like your whole software program pretty much turns over in the space of the first year, two, three. And then it goes down. You're not taking in so much more new from this idea or group because you've already taken in the bulk of it in the first couple of years of exposure. But you're fine-tuning, you're tweaking, you're throwing some stuff out. Was it like that for you? Like the first 3 or 4 years were huge conceptual and behavioral changes?
Probably. I would say that's probably true, yes. That in the very beginning, when I started to think about what was going on in my family and how could I see it better, just having that very thought, you're less reactive to what is going on. Just that you want to be a better observer and understand the family patterns before you start taking action. And the easier things for me to understand were to get rid of blame. So I used it at the psychiatric hospital, do an orientation program for new people, and I would say, are there good guys and bad guys in your family? And people would love that topic, and they'd love to come there and talk about it. And at the end of an hour, hour and a half, people would be like, yeah, let's get rid of blame and shame. And, you know, bad guys aren't bad guys. They're under some influence, and maybe I'm making them a bad guy by focusing on them and trying to fix them. So people began taking more responsibility for self, who were in the families of these alcoholics. And I think I was doing that myself. I was not trying to get my brother to change for me so that I could be a calmer person, to quit drinking or to take his medication or to get a job or whatever I might have thought he ought to and should be doing. I was able to ask more questions like, well, how much beer do you need to drink before you feel calm? Mm. And when does all that beer start influencing you so you can't play golf or you can't go surfing? Mm-hmm. And how many days will it take you to recover from drinking all that beer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was able to be more thoughtful in relationship with him. And then I was able to set more limits. If you're going to get real excited and talk about this and that and carry on, I have to tell you, I'm getting a headache. I'm getting an upset stomach. And I need to hang up now and to recover a little bit, and then I'll call you back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was beginning to set limits not trying to get him to do the right thing. Then the third step was I started saying, you know, I was working, I wasn't making that much money, so I'd say, I'm really worried about the bills. I'm really worried about, can I put it, I need a new roof on my house, and I don't know how I'm going to do that. And he would say, well, maybe I can help you. You know, so the two of us would get up there, you know, put the shingles on the roof and have to clean up afterwards.
So you deliberately underfunctioned.
I deliberately underfunctioned. He helped me do a driveway. I deliberately underfunctioned. And for years, I had been overfunctioning. And that happened, what I used to call Bowen moments. They're just moments when all this intellectual stuff that you're learning transfers itself into a moment of more contact with the other person in a genuine way that you didn't plan. It just happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew all this stuff about overfunctioning for people, about enabling people and this and that. And one day, I just was on the porch talking to my brother, and I said, you know, I realized that you really are the white knight on the horse in our family. You've really been the one to absorb all the anxiety and enable other people to function better.
Wow.
And he said, you're the only one in the family that realizes that. So that was a moment. Other moments would be where things changed, would be my brother would call up and say, I was driving the car, and I had a few beers, I banged my car into a tree, and I think I broke my nose, and would you come over here and look at my nose? And I'd say, if I come over and look at your nose, I'm willing to do that. But I'm not going to tell you whether you should go to the hospital or the doctor like I used to. And then you hate me because I told you what to do. So I'm not doing that. But I'll come over and look at your nose. Mm-hmm. But you can very well decide whether you should go to a doctor or not. Not me. So I was able to use moments to admit my past errors and connect my change in behavior to not wanting to replicate those same patterns. And those were kind of fun moments.
Were most of the ones you described, were they in the first 5, 6, 8 years?
Yeah, those were in the first few years before. Mm-hmm. So I met Dr. Bowen in 76. I took 4 years of postgraduate training. And during those 4 years, I would drive up from Virginia Beach to Washington, stay with my family and relatives here and there, and go to the postgraduate training. And at the end of those 4 years, Dr. Bowen said, you know, I'm thinking about hiring you as the audiovisual coordinator, would you be interested? And I'm like, yeah, you kidding me? I work for you. And then I'm like, oh, wait, I have two children. You know, one's going to be a senior in high school, one's going to be a junior in high school. They probably don't want to move with me, but I'll figure out what I'm going to do about this. And he said, good. And so I went back and I told my ex-husband, I said, I have a chance for a job in Washington. Would you like to have the kids live with you? Because I know they're not going to want to move with me. And I don't want to take this job unless you would like them to do that. And so he said, I would love it. I would love the opportunity to live with the kids again.
Hmm.
So I said, great. So then I told the children, and they're like, fine, see you later, Mom. You know, but they weren't, I don't think, terribly traumatized by it. But yes, a lot of things changed.
So you entered the Bowen Center as the AV lady.
As the AV lady, 2 years of college. 4 years of postgraduate, the only person ever to be accepted in the postgraduate program without a terminal degree.
Do you ever think, or have you ever thought, of where career-wise, occupation-wise, you would have gone? It's obviously not real estate, but if you hadn't had this, the problems with the brother and the family as a drive to push you in a certain direction, where else in the workplace might you have gone back there in the 70s?
Well, I was a really good tennis player. I was ranked 10th in the state of Virginia at one time. And when I was young, if I'd had a career, I probably would have wanted to try to train myself to go to Wimbledon or something like that. That, you know, probably would have been a first choice. Second choice would be, I love books. I love reading. I've always loved to read. So I might have gone into owning my own bookstore. I like building. And if I developed, my grandfather was also a real estate developer. There are quite a few real estate people. So if I'd stayed with real estate, I would have become a developer, I think, or building. I have very good spatial awareness. I don't think I would have ever wanted to go to architecture school or anything like that.
Too precise?
Yeah, or probably
too mechanical.
Too mechanical, maybe too precise. But I think I'm definitely an idea person. So development or something like that. Owning stores, I thought it'd be great to own a series of bookstores that sold music and food and, mm-hmm. you know, had a nice ambience, maybe an art museum associated with it. Something
the
like
old
that.
Olson's model before Borders came along.
Yeah, exactly. But Olson's, you know, was probably not a good financial model, and I probably would have figured that out. I'm a practical person.
Was there a book before this one, or a book concept that didn't become a book, but might have?
Well, I was kind of kidding, but sort of serious about the idea. I thought more about a movie than writing a book. But the book, if I'd written a book about my adventures with my brother, Seriously Crazy, I think that movies can make a tremendous impact on people's thinking. You can take a lot of great ideas and put it into a movie, and it really can make a significant difference in how people think about things. So I really thought early on, especially with my audiovisual work, that I might like to go into producing movies or writing scripts or something like that.
Were you able to spin off any of those interests or skills into your work with the archives here? Documentary or anything like that?
No, I really was not able to. There's a woman who wrote a book, Maggie Scarf.
Yeah.
And she was kind of interested in coming here into the postgraduate program and learning more about it and maybe even writing up Dr. Bowen's autobiography. But when my mind thinks about things, I'm not such a linear person as to do Dr. Bowen's autobiography. I thought about you might do a story about Dr. Bowen and then show, like, how the monkeys manage relationship networks or how mice manage relationship networks. So you might put in more like Sesame Street, the real characters, the real people, and then these other ideas that connect more to biology. And so I sort of wanted a movie that would provoke thinking. I really liked Woody Allen's movie called Zelig, which is all about fusion. He's a chameleon, famous, I think he might have been a politician, I'm not sure, an actor or a politician, but he has so much fusion that if he stands next to a Chinese man, he becomes Chinese. If he stands next to a fat person, he becomes fat, you know. And I thought, this is a great movie about fusion, what happens at a cellular level
right.
with people. So I thought there might be funny and clever ways of introducing the ideas in a movie format, but I never wrote a script. I never did anything practical with it. I started practically thinking about a book, I think, as I got closer to wanting to retire. Now think about, what do I owe for all the years of training that I have had?
Mm-hmm.
How can I give something back to the world for all that I've been given?
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to do that is to write a book. And I'm not a great writer, so I thought, well, maybe 150 pages, a good editor, and then I could contribute something, and maybe I could write two or three books. And so that started.
You're saying if you got through the trauma of the first one, then
I could write some more. Right, exactly. Prove myself.
Getting down to the business or the day-to-day work, the week-to-week work of being an author, for starters, what can you tell us about your editor, Debbie Schwab?
Debbie Schwab is a third-degree black belt. I met her at my karate studio up in Darien, Connecticut. She's a magazine editor. And again, just like Donna Willis, I'm looking for somebody just like you who can talk to me about what they don't understand so that I can slow down and explain it. If I'm going to write a book, it's got to be logical. I can't be jumping all over the place talking about Bertram Russell and this and that, you know. So Deb Schwab is a woman who can keep it in a conversational style, get me to explain the leaps when I take them, and put my ideas together in a readable format.
Just have one chapter called Stuff for the Really Adventurous and stick all the stuff that the rest of us won't let you have anywhere else in there.
That's a great idea. I love that idea. That's a fabulous idea. Stuff for the Really Adventurous.
And you're almost defying them to walk in there and try
exactly.
it out.
Exactly. I love that idea. It's a great idea. So she, you know, Deb is about my age, and she's interested in ideas. So she's a conceptual person, but she knows how to communicate. She's written for a magazine.
So tell us a little bit just about, mechanics is kind of a sterile word, but just the process, the yin-yang, whatever, of working with an editor. How do you go about it as a writer?
Well, I think what I do is I try my best to be kind of logical and just know that it's not going to be that logical. Give it to
Deb. In the drafting.
Yeah, in the draft. Just write up what I think. And then know that if it goes through four or five edits and re-edits, it'll be somewhere close to what I want. So I recognize that in the beginning it's going to be a process of creating a dialogue between myself and my editor. I'm going to tell all these ideas that I have, and then they're going to slowly take more shape. And the thing that I like about Deb Schwab and Donna Willis is both of them really want me to speak in my own voice. So they don't want to reorganize my ideas as their ideas, or mm-hmm. that I should do mm-hmm. what they think or communicate. So they both have a great deal of respect for my own ideas.
And in no way are they trying to be co-authors or junior right. authors. They're keeping the editing role separate right. from the creativity role.
But they want to understand what I'm thinking. So they're really curious people. You're a really curious person. So I do much better with those kind of people. I think better in the presence of curious people, and I can explain better. So the person that I'm working with has to be able to set some limits, keep me on task, and be really curious for their own good, for their own interest.
Yeah, it's a good job description, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I think a really good editor does. Very curious, very open-minded, but keeps people on tasks. Keeps them organized and is never afraid. Well, Deb will say, you know, did I hurt your feelings by saying this or that? I'm like,
Well, I don't have feelings.
Yeah, where are my feelings? I don't have any feelings. What are you talking about? Feelings. Disregarded those feelings. Yeah. They came up. I looked at it. I said, yeah, I'm hurt. And then I said, get over it. And I got over it. Yeah. So she's a kind person, too. And that's probably necessary. If you're going to work with creative people, to have a kind heart, to be open.
Who would you say, and you're allowed to change this totally as the manuscript spins itself out, but give me some, not even, who are the types of people that are in the front row of the audience? The types of people you're trying to get to applaud, throw flowers, grimace, just get reactions in contact with. For the book?
Well, I think number one, it would have to be people who are financially independent. That is, they have a job, they can make money, they're not probably still in college or, you know, they're, so maybe 25 to 65.
All right.
You know, more probably people who haven't, who are still considering different options. So that might be more the late 20s, early 30s, even 40s. Even people in their 40s are still searching and thinking and staying open and willing to consider different things.
But most of those are Generation Xers.
And generation,
you and I have talked in the past yeah. about the brutal realism, the censoriness, the quick sort of reactivity of that generation.
Right. So
that's a tougher sell.
It's a tougher sell. But I still say those people are people to whom life is very important. They're people who are going to get a career first and have a family afterwards.
Okay.
They, if I challenge them and say, okay, write down the names of five people who've been important to you, and then analyze the story that you remember about what you learned from those people. I mean, I think those are people who can do that. That kind of makes sense to them. They can kind of do that. They can self-analyze. They can think, yes, there are five people who've been important to me, and I can tell you who they are, darn it.
Actually, my experience on the generations issue, Xers will be more likely to think in terms of five people, whereas boomers would be more likely to think in terms of five ideas or five principles or more abstract type things.
Right.
I think Generation Xers will find it easier to personalize it.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm looking for. People who can personalize it, who want to change themselves to be more effective people as leaders. And that they're looking for, they don't want to go to, you know, another class where they learn to do 360s. How many times do you go to the people at your work and ask them, well, what did you think about the way I function? You know,
right.
And all that does in one way is make the leader...
It was good up until the time you asked that question.
Yeah, it makes the leader more sensitive to the perceptions of their, you know, the people who they work with. When that may or may not be good, because they may then be more influenced by the group than by what they think. So then they've lost their edge of leadership, you know. I don't know. There are a lot of problems with the way leadership is taught.
Good. Let's go into that. That was the next question, actually.
And, you know, I think that you can pick up any book and you can see that it's really divorced. Almost all books on leadership are divorced from your real life. They don't care about your real life. They just want you to learn this and that that has these principles and these things that you do at work and how you get the team to grow and blah, blah, blah. And how you deal with the politics in your work system and this and that and what type you are and what type they are. And they don't care about who you are. I haven't heard anything about caring about who you are. But if I ask you to write down the names of five people who are important to you and what did you learn from them, we're starting from the premise of who are you and what's important to you and what's really worked for you in the past. And how can you use those skills to build into the future?
That's great for coaching or counseling or a retreat, but a book author, how are you going to have your potential reader do the, well, you're doing
yeah.
it in the first chapter.
I'm going to do it in the first chapter. I'm going to say, name the five people, write the stories down. I'll leave a little space, you know, a few blank pages. Maybe it'll be a 200-page book and let them use it as a notebook or not. Or just say, I'm not going to do that exercise. I'm a boomer. I'm not going to do that.
Give me the brand theory first.
But I want to involve people at a personal level in understanding I am interested in changing myself. If I can change myself and understand more about how to relate to people, I'm going to be a better leader. So I'm looking for personal buy-in.
What do you make about, I bought Jack Welch, a friend of mine asked me to review Jack Welch's book. I wasn't that keen on it because books by big business people, I just never really got into them. I'm
yeah.
surprised how good some parts of this the second Jack Welch book is, Winning.
Yeah.
But in general, many of the leadership books have been by Lee Iacocca and Lou Gerstner. Lou Gerstner's also written a good book, but
yeah,
if you've never run a large corporation, I'm not sure how real it can possibly be to you.
Yeah.
You're saying there's too many books out there like that and people want a more near-at-hand type version of leadership?
I think that's right. I think the most of what's out there is too broad. I love all those books, too. I love The Elephant in the Room or whatever it was when he went to IBM.
Who says elephants can't dance?
Elephants can't dance, right. He went to IBM and they had their way of doing things, their whole bureaucracy, and they're going to show the PowerPoint slides. And he just turns the switch off and says, no, you're not going to do a PowerPoint slide. I want you to stand right up here, talk to me, and explain to me in 5 minutes what's important here.
Yeah, right.
And he just changed the whole culture, you know, by doing that. It took several more years, but it was his personal effort. And I think he can be an inspiration to people to say, you've got to risk being a self in a system.
So that's an example of leading by example.
Leading by example. And I think many of those books are good on that level. These are people who led by example.
But they could afford to do that after they become the CEO. You're talking about people who are in the trenches.
Well, look at Jack Welch. I mean, he's a perfect example of a guy who, although he, again, didn't understand relationships with his own family, which he readily admits, he did understand relationships at work. He understood the primary focus had to be on getting people to succeed. And his job as a leader was to enable people to succeed. And he had to do that. And he had this other idea there was going to be no blame if it didn't work out. So if people weren't functioning well, he said, you have talents. They're not being used well here. You might want to use your talent somewhere else. And then he enabled other people to learn these kinds of
somewhere else outside the company.
Yeah, somewhere else outside the company, yeah.
That may have felt like blame to the person who was asked to leave.
Yeah, but he always highlighted the person's strengths. Okay. You have skills. But, I mean, the guy's a genius at understanding how to form teams, how to enable people to be successful, and that you have a personal responsibility in enabling the people that work for you to be successful. I don't know anybody better at it than Jack Welch.
I'm going to go back to the audience, but a quick, not really a detour, it's a big issue. But could you tell me what you see as the differences between management, quote-unquote, and leadership, quote-unquote?
Well, I think management has a dictionary definition of what the job is.
Yeah, but you don't usually accept those.
Yeah, but it's more management. You really are operating under a contract again. You can be a leader as a manager if you want to risk. And that has to do with just, you know, what we were talking about last time. The people who are at second or third levels who are managers and who have, for lack of a better word, let the boss off the hook by doing more and more stuff for them.
Right.
That is the biggest challenge for managers. How do you lead the leader? How do you become a leader so that you can enable your boss to become a leader? That's a very...
Is that delegating upward?
Well, it's holding people responsible somehow or another. Whether you joke with them, take them out to lunch, however you do it, but you somehow manage to have an open enough relationship, maybe by creating other relationships, that you can be more authentic.
Hasn't the secular religion of the last 20 years in management been, though, that you push the decisions and the control, quote, down to the lowest possible level? Sounds like...
Well, that is another way of thinking about increasing personal responsibility
right.
for people at the lower levels. And that is true. People at the lower levels, like Dell Computer or whatever, they need to solve those problems. They don't need to be asking Michael Dell, what can I do about this? You need to be able to think for yourself. So, yes, you want more personal responsibility everywhere. But what I've seen in the companies and with top executives that I've consulted with is that they're the middle manager types, the second, third, fourth level of people. Their hardest job is managing how they're going to manage their relationship with their boss.
Yeah, right.
That's way harder than empowering or enabling people to take personal responsibility for people who are lower down.
Gotcha, right.
It's more complicated. So I think that's where a manager does become a leader, and that is by taking responsibility to have a relationship with their boss that enables their boss to function better, rather than just do whatever the boss wants. Well, the boss wants this, the boss wants that. Okay, do it. Don't even think about it. Just do it.
But going back to some of the discussions that people around here have had, particularly during Kathy Weissman's dinner party on April 16th, three of the four discussion groups went right into the question of should you take a consulting assignment from a CEO or boss figure when that person doesn't admit that he or she is part of the system, part of the culture, therefore part of the problem, and also part of the solution. Here, can the person who's trying to manage upward and have awareness in that relationship, you don't have a question of whether you take the assignment or not. You're already in it.
Well, there are two things. One, I said earlier, you might have to leave. You might, when you're going to try to have a better relationship with your boss, you have to say, he might not like it and he might want me to leave. So I have to have my resume ready. I have to be able to leave. I'm not going to just be a yes man, if I'm really going to enable my boss to function better, then I have to be ready to leave. So don't even think about being a leader if you're a management type unless you're willing to leave.
Right.
So that would be one.
A leader has to be ready to be a leaver.
Exactly. in order to be a leader. And I think that people who have managers who do this, who are not yes people, are extremely grateful and recognize that person as a contributing person.
So is this a fair summary? You were saying that in medium-sized and larger institutions, a manager is a person who's working with contracts and has some higher fire, but to be a leader, he or she has to start. Finish the thought.
has to start thinking about the impact of their relationship on other people's functioning. That's
okay. A leader, around them, below them, and on top of them.
Around them, below them, and on top of them. And be willing to take a risk to improve people's functioning. Stanley Milgram was a psychologist who thought it would be interesting. He was interested in the Holocaust and how people got people to do horrible things. You know, reasonably nice people. Some of Hitler's people were reasonably nice. How did they get him to do such awful things? So he constructed an experiment where he asked people in the university area, and then he asked people, you know, in the way far away from the university shopping center area, to participate in an experiment. The experiment was, we're trying to teach people to learn faster, and if they make a mistake, we shock them. And we start out here with low shocks, and then we can go all the way up to life-threatening shocks. And so you'll have an instructor by you, and the instructor wore a white coat, and they'll tell you when to shock the person if they make a mistake. And from that, they will learn faster how to remember things. So there's a good outcome here. And we're going to help these people. And help them, they did. And he found out a startling and very unsettling fact that they put in the Enron movie. 60-some percent of people were willing to shock people to death, to the threat of death. And people would say, the experimenter who was being paid $15 a day or whatever would say, well, wait a minute, this person's really suffering. Hear their cries. I don't think we should do this. And the guy with the white coat would say, we need to finish the experiment. You need to do your job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have a contract with America, whatever. Let's finish the job. And they would do it. And they, that was such a horrible and disgraceful thing that the records were sealed so that nobody knew about these participants, who they were and whatever. And this woman, Lauren Slater, came along and interviewed some of them in her book, I think, of the 100 most mind-boggling experiments in psychology. And the one that I remember reading, the guy said, what I learned from that experiment is that I will never just take what somebody tells me to do without assuming personal responsibility, because I saw what would happen if I let the guy in the white coat tell me what to do, and I did it just because he said it was okay.
That experiment was in the 60s?
Yeah, it's in that piece of paper I gave you, if you want to know the exact
okay,
date.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's right in there, in the footnotes.
Sure.
You can check it out. But
so basically we found out that 60% of normal Americans could become Nazis under
exactly,
the right circumstances.
Under the right circumstances. Stanley Milgram, it's called Obedience to Authority, 1974.
Oh, that late, okay.
1974. The other ones that are in here that are also just extremely upsetting. I don't know if you've heard of the prison experiment, but that was another one that happened in 1971. Stanford psychologist Philip Zimbardo paid people again $15 a day to, by the flip of the coin, be either a prisoner or a free guard. And he had to end that experiment after 5 days because these normal people had become their numbers. They had become their roles. They'd forgotten in 5 days who they really were as people. The force for togetherness and the difficulty of being a leader, the difficulty of being...
Well, you use the word togetherness as opposed to groupthink or fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Togetherness is a word that was popular back in the 50s, and it connoted family values and
we're all
nice stuff in the suburbs.
Nice. That's why it's beguiling, seductive.
And why don't you pick a nastier word as the bad part?
I can't, because togetherness is not all bad, but you need to be aware of the double-edged sword. There's some good things about it, and then there's some difficult things. Togetherness is so prevalent. It's so much a part of our lives. It's not an evil thing. It's part of love. It's part of caring. It's part of being a member of a church. It's part of being a member of a bowling league. But don't forget about personal responsibility when it comes to making decisions. That's all. That's what can be eroded away.
You gave me a little bit of a new twist when I said who was in the very front row of the audience, and you talked about an age range, and it was heavily slanted toward Generation Xers, pragmatism, problem solving, people who were curious about themselves, the exercise of the five people who made a difference for you. Any other types or occupations or, you know, examples of who else is in the audience that would differ from what we've already talked about?
Well, I would hope that people, you know, like Norman Johnson, I think that people, systems thinkers, who are like the Santa Fe Institute people, that very thoughtful people would be in the audience. But I think Gary Resnick and Norman Johnson, they're the kind of people who are open to ideas. They might question them, they might doubt them, they might not buy them. But how, you know, what percentage of the audience, if I hope to sell 25,000 books, which would be a lot of books, if I could sell that many people, how many of those 25,000 are going to be idea people? And they're, you know, a small percentage, but they can have a major impact. So a major impact person might be, you know, suppose I got the people who develop SimCity software, for instance, or Electronic Arts people who develop software to be in the audience. That'd be fabulous. It'd be fabulous because maybe they would think, you know what, we can develop a game like this.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And we can begin to use systems modeling ideas to develop tools, you know, that we can give away and sell more of our... So, you know, I hold out the hope for 1-2% of people to be people, idea people, who are going to take these things and take them into a whole nother realm. Video games, movies, you know. I don't know. But that would be awfully nice. And I think that because I've met and been influenced by Norman Johnson and Gary Resnick, I think that, you know, I think that's possible.
One group I haven't heard you referred to, and nobody's saying, I don't want these people to read my book, so I'm not taking it as you're inviting them to go jump in the lake, but are middle and upper managers at Fortune 500 companies in the audience?
Well, the people who really want to make a difference and who are willing to risk their relationship with their boss, yes.
Okay, and that would probably include some of those same types of people in government agencies.
And government agencies, and they, you know, these are just people who, in one way or another, want to do their best. In one way or another, it's more important to them to do their best than have job security. They're more willing to change jobs in order to contribute or do their best than they are to have a paycheck. So it's, you know, you're really, I think, in reading a book like this, saying to yourself, I want to read this book because I'm interested in ideas about how I might be more effective, how I might be make a big difference. How can I make a big difference with my life? So they're not going to be security-oriented people of, I've got six kids and a family and I can't take any risks and I'm not reading that book.
Okay, that's good. You've ruled out people and ruled in people, and you've been very clear about both. Do you have an organizational scheme yet, or are you sort of going chapter by chapter, and then you'll sort of piece, you and Debbie will sort of piece them together in a way that makes sense?
Well, as I said before, I'm willing to understand that my process is many rewrites, 4 or 5 rewrites easily. So right now I have an outline or a model for the book in which I'm trying to take Bowen theory and put it into the form of a compass, where I say north is whatever it is that you want to do. I want to do this. I will do this. I won't do that. And then south is going to be, oh my gosh, if I say I am going to do this, there's going to be an avalanche of problems. There's going to be resistance to this. And then I have to, in order to overcome that resistance, I have to understand the history of relationships that are in my life and my strengths and my skills. And I have to understand, to some extent, the relationship system that I'm entering. In order to make a change in any system, you've got to be willing to be alone, to stand alone, to be more sure of what you will and won't do, and then go back into that system. So that's the...
Alone or apart? And there, that's a significant difference.
Yeah, you have to be, I do believe you have to be alone.
At the point of decision.
To make new ideas your own. At the point of decision, you've got to really somehow, these ideas, the strategy, the implementation of it, it's got to be yours to the core. So you've got to spend some time by yourself in order to change yourself first. Then you go back into the system, and then you're going to encounter further changes. But I've never personally seen anybody go through major changes who hasn't spent some time alone really considering the ramifications on their lives for the change they're willing to undergo.
If you could state the book's agenda as a series of questions, in other words, the things you're reading, writing, they constitute an attempt to answer those questions, what would a few of those questions be? And sometimes it's tough to state them as questions, but maybe hypothesis, you could state them as hypotheses. Either way is good.
I'd say one question might be, what is it that I learned that I haven't been paying attention to? What did I learn about being a leader? And I think Art House is a good example of
that's
this.
That's a question you want the reader to be asking.
Yeah, okay. Right. But when I interviewed him, he made that clear that by asking these questions, he was able to think about things about his own strength and his own development that he'd never thought of before. So that's what I'd like other people to do. You have strengths. There are things that you know that you're not even aware of that you know. And so the question would be, how can I use the strengths or the wisdom even that I already have, but that I'm not aware of?
That's a good goal for the book, phrased as a question, an ideal question that the reader would come away with. But you are also trying to answer questions for you by writing the book.
Yeah.
So that's what I was sort of more trying to get at.
Okay, the questions that I have by writing the book. Well, the question that I had in approaching this topic was, I've spent 30 years being a family therapist. I've seen leaders emerge in families. But they're coming to me already in pain. What about well-functioning people who don't? I'm just so curious. How do they emerge as leaders in their families?
And it sounds and like you're also mean professional families,
they're
too.
They're professional families. How do they? And, you know, and Jack Welch, again, is another example, kind of like Einstein. They didn't have great personal lives. They took their knowledge and used it in their work situations where it was easier for them.
So to that extent, that question could be called a mega research topic that unifies your work on your own book.
Mm-hmm.
How do people emerge as leaders when there's no obvious reason for them to be that way? There's no crisis. There's no people have made a big investment in you.
Mm-hmm. And Gary Resnick tried to answer that question, and I thought he did a reasonable good job of saying it has something to do with intelligence. He said, for me, people look to me as a leader because I could solve problems.
Yeah. He could help people think through.
And he didn't have to take all the glory, so he could enable people to do well themselves. And he had that ability, I think he even called it a schizophrenic ability, to be as much for the person as he was for the institution.
Yeah, right.
And people recognized that, and they appreciated it. So I think that's an important concept.
What other questions would you welcome ideas, feedback, contacts, articles on from your ever-scintillating wide group of friends and allies out there?
Well, I think that probably people have seen things or have observed things about the emergence of leadership. And again, I'm going to just go back to Art House because I thought his was an interesting story. That when he started thinking and reflecting on how did I get to be a leader, he started thinking about when he was at boarding school and they had different ethics, different values than he did.
This was a great story, and it's on the first Leaders for Tomorrow disc, which you can get by leaving a message at ideas2action.com. Go ahead.
Exactly. And he said, you know, he realized he could not participate in that, and that his ability to step back from that had given him great strength.
But he couldn't quit the school either, so he had to stay independent. But in the
he
environment.
He stayed there in that environment. He kept relating to people.
At age 14, yes.
Yeah, all the way through high school. And they messed with him about his grades and going to college and this and that, but he made it all work out.
So you're looking for specific stories like that.
Yeah, and I think that's a great story and a great insight into what enabled Art House to go to the White House and talk to the Vice President about how he saw Iraq and what the pitfalls might be in the invasion and this and that. And he could, you know, put his viewpoint out with people in a respectful way. And he can listen to people in a respectful way.
Any other angles or leads that you are particularly open to in terms of friends?
I think that, you know, when you think about the future problems for Earth, with 6 billion going to, I don't know, 10, 11 billion over the next 40, 50 years, that the major thing is going to be, how do people learn to tolerate differences? And I think a visionary leader might possibly know something more about this, about the ability to allow people to express their different viewpoints without going to war or killing each other. And I think this is going to be a very big issue, and I think that's why the concept that you can be a well-defined leader and manage to listen to other people yet hold yourself and the other person responsible is going to have a major impact. And I think there's some great stories that people have about how they've seen this one way or the other.
So brings us to the end of Leaders for Tomorrow, disc number 3. It's the summer of 2005. Thanks to Andrea for bringing us up to date on what will be a great book. And any comments, questions you have, as always, arms711@aol.com or frankgregorski@aol.com if you're interested in the editorial side of producing a book.
Thank you so much, Frank. As always, you made me think about a lot of wild and wonderful things. Appreciate that.
Take care,
folks.
Okay. Good night.
Bye.